Jeremy, last time he was here in October last year, I introduced him as being involved with the Mau Mau uprising. I hope to correct that tonight. Jeremy knows what it is to lose a homeland he loved. In 1962, with his native Kenya in turmoil, he moved his young family to Australia, a land shining bright with freedom. But it wasn't long before he recognised the same storm clouds gathering over his adopted country. Deep concern led him to question, examine, to probe, and to speak out. Over the next 30 years, he became a vocal voice for freedom. Exposing world powers, hidden agendas, and economic fraud has attracted the enmity of people in high places. He has given vital keys to the people who believe that the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And without any further introduction, I'd like you to welcome Jeremy Lee.
I hate standing behind something this big, but never mind. It stops you seeing how slim I've got since I was last here. I want to cover some of the same ground and try and raise in your mind a question about where we are and where we're going, because the Australia that we've had in the past is unravelling now. And the speed of that unravelling is getting much greater, and one of the signs of that is so many people who are confused about what is going on. Now, this isn't only in Australia, it's happening in every country in the world. For example, you've probably heard the news today that there's been a big landslide in England in the election, and the major government has gone out, and the Tony Blair government has now come in with one of the biggest changes in British history. And yet, yesterday, a poll run in England asking how many people believed that Blair would fulfill his promises, 19% said yes, and the rest said no. That is, over 80%, although they voted for a new government and want a change, don't believe they're going to get what they voted for. And that is symptomatic of what is happening in every country. Because we can conceive of no other mechanism than to go and express anger when we have elections does not mean that people favour the incoming group at all. A number of polls that have been run in Australia show that people simply don't believe politicians and they don't believe governments and they're disillusioned about the voting system. And most people under 25 now are finding it much more convenient not to register to go and vote because they don't think it makes any difference. And their fathers and their mothers get very annoyed with them and say, look, you know, the future of the country is in your hands. And if you don't take an interest in your country, who knows where we're going to end up? So the kids say to their parents, well, do you think it makes any difference? And if they catch their father in an off guard, he says, well, no, it doesn't really. So they laugh like steam and walk off. I mean, why go through the motion of doing all this if it's not really changing things? And so what I want to try and get across tonight is that the real issue is not about whether we have a new world order or whether we have a federal government or whether we do away with national sovereignty or those things. The real issue is whether you have a say over your own life or not, because that's what's being played with at the present time. On the way down here, I've just came from Sydney the other night. We had a meeting two nights ago in Sydney, and then I had a meeting in Batemans Bay and came down through that fishing area on the south coast of New South Wales. And all the way down, there is anger and frustration and the most terrible bureaucracy. We had a meeting of a number of fishermen down at Batemans Bay who I discovered now have to have 68 licenses before they can take their boats out to catch some fish. And even when they get 30 miles out, there's a whole range of fish they're not allowed to catch. And if they're caught with just one, when they come back to harbour, there's a $1,000 fine. But 31 miles out, all the Soviet fishing fleets are still there, and they can catch anything they want, as much as they want. And you can imagine the frustration, because they're actually in territorial waters for Australia, that they can catch fish and Australians can't. And that's the same anger that's going on in Britain and Europe and other parts of the world. There was a beekeeper who grabbed me before I came in and told me, tell the people that they're going to wreck the whole honey industry because they want to put the bees under town planners instead of under agricultural inspectors who know something about the honey industry. Can you imagine the town planner of Pakenham or something trying to regulate bees? And I remember when I last went round Canada, exactly the same thing was going on there. We had one meeting in the Okanagan in British Columbia that was stacked with beekeepers. Somebody told me a poem about bees. The bee's a busy little soul. He has no time for birth control. And that is why at times like these we have so many sons of bees. Over the last few years, I've been trying to explain to people how power is being shifted away from the individual into greater and greater bureaucratic centers, first regionalized, and then from there it's centralized, and now it's being internationalized and finally globalized. And there's a whole lot of talk about efficiency and how much better it's going to be when we get there. And there's no doubt that there's a lot of people who really seriously believe that the more you could centralize power into the hands of people who really know what they're doing, intelligent people who have the best interests of the world at heart, how much better it's going to be. And that in this amazing age of the information superhighway and the incredible speed with which information can be exchanged and in which analysis can be made of what is happening, that that's the way to go. And so one of the features of what is happening are immense bureaucracies under names that we don't even pronounce now. We simply use initials, the FAO or UNIDO or UNCTAD or UNICEF or this, whatever it happens to be. You get terribly muddled up with all these initials, but somebody must understand them. And in each of these, they take divisions of human affairs, whether it's social or medical or economic or ecological, and they try and produce plans on how the world is going to solve its problems. And there's no doubt now that we've got the capacity to be able to get a picture of things that were never possible before. We've got people sitting behind computers in UNCTAD, United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, who seriously think they can produce what is called supply management for a world dairy industry. We can work out how much milk is needed, and how much cheese is needed, and how much butter is needed, and what are the most suitable countries for producing that sort of thing, and how many empty mouths need cheese and butter and milk, and all you've got to do is correlate those two together and do it on a global scale, and we've solved problems that have never been solved by human beings before. So quite seriously, you've got people sitting behind computers on which you could now put every cow in the world. There's no doubt about that. We've got all the analysis and all the data that we need to do that. You can have every cow in New Zealand and every cow in Australia and Denmark and Norway and all those cows that are wintered over that terrible winter in Canada and what happens in America and other parts of the world. And if you want to go further than that, you've only got to press another button and you can get average milk production per herd, per area in this country or that country. And if you can then feed in a new type of program, you can get the picture coming out about how much milk we need and how many people need milk. I mean, what's simpler? But then you take one of these people sitting behind these computers, planning the whole world's dairy production, and take them outside and say, look, there is just one cow. You see if you can milk it. And they wouldn't have the first chance. They wouldn't even know which end to feed and which end to milk. They wouldn't know what to do if it made a noise. They wouldn't know what to do if it gave more than milk, except to get out of the way. And nevertheless, despite that sort of human limitation, they see no qualms in being in a situation where they're trying to plan the world's dairy industry. It is a form of madness now that human beings conceive that they can plan the world somehow and produce the most efficient results, and everybody's going to be happy. But gradually, as this has got closer and closer towards some sort of culmination, a new idea is beginning dimly to be thought. And that idea is, what happens if this centralized power structure that is being built does not deliver what the people want? What happens if the people of Australia decide that the particular international program for Australia is not what they really require at all? They want something different. Do we simply say, well, that's the end of that. We can exchange it. We can get out of this. We'll have a vote and put a new party in and they'll change it round and we'll go back to normal again. And the answer quite obviously is no, because one of the things that is sacrificed in this progressive centralization of power is the right of you and I to sanction it or disagree with it or change it, because that is expendable. You can't have the two together. There is no such thing as freedom and order in that sense. It's either one or the other. The things we're going to have to settle for, if we do go as far as having a totally globalized world, is the right of men and women to say no. You won't have that right. So for the first time, we're beginning to get articles coming out canvassing whether that is a big enough price to pay or whether it's too big a price to pay. There's a new book just come out called Connexity. They invent new words as they invent new power structures. This one was reviewed in The Australian, April the 29th, which is what, 3 days ago or something. How to foster freedom and interdependence. The author is canvassing this question. He asks this. The question I pose is a simple one. Are the achievement of freedom and the growth of interdependence compatible, or are we doomed to a classical tragedy in which our love of freedom destroys our capacity to be interdependent? And he goes on, you know, which way do we go on this question? Today's attempts to steer the world are being systematically skewed by the use of outdated concepts that dominate political thought. Ideas that made sense and contributed to progress in an earlier period but have now become barriers. Almost all of these concepts share one feature. They define social units in terms of their separateness rather than their connections. One set of the ideas of belonging, such as nationalism and national sovereignty, or the belief in exclusive identities of religion or ethnicity. All of these ideas divide the world between us and them. From the legitimate view that we need to belong to and take pride in larger entities, they draw the illegitimate conclusion that one identity can demand an exclusive attachment. In this way, an idea that suited an age of clear-cut territorial boundaries is transposed into an environment in which it no longer makes sense. Another set of concepts are those of liberal politics, which imagines the individual as a self-sufficient entity, not informed by society and owing nothing to it, but rather heroic in his or her isolation, and defined by a series of claims that can be made on society. Most influential of all, perhaps, are the ideas of orthodox economics, which is founded on the idea of the sovereignty of the individual as consumer and the firm as trader. Again, ideas that treat the separate boxes as primary. None of these concepts belongs to a world of interconnectedness. Because all of them treat the outside world as residual, they have no clear sense of limits. Their advocates remain articulate and vocal, but in important respects, they have become prisoners of the past. Confronted by new problems, they simply reach for old tools, and the institutions they guide produce an inadequate, distorted social order. Terribly erudite stuff, but in essence, they're saying, we still find people in this world who tend to sort of measure things that are happening by old concepts. Strange ideas that government is there for the people and not the people to the government. That we should have some say in our own future. What an outmoded, silly idea, according to this. That individuals are unique and different from each other. That we are more than just ciphers and numbers. That every single person in this room tonight is different from the person they're sitting next to or anybody else in this room. That they were born with the absolutely unique talents, perceptions, markings, fingerprints, dreams, abilities, and that really the reason they are here on this earth is to develop those things, not to have them suppressed and equalized and turned into one mass blob at all. That the world and your nation is here for you. You're not here for it. And if there is a value in patriotism or nationalism or community loyalties or family loyalties. To me, at any rate, it is only insofar as they foster this idea that you are free, that you are a free being, that you can make free choices. And any type of nationalism or internationalism, for that matter, which says your country is more important than the contributing parts of it, the human beings who make it up, has taken a demoralizing choice that is going to wreck us before this is finished. Now, the idea that is being sold to our kids and educated into us and pushed and planned and put on computer is this strange idea that we've got to sacrifice individuality in order to have an ordered world that solves all the problems. And that means that we can't have freedom. We've got to have a group or an elite that runs the place and makes the decisions for us. And if we could only be persuaded to accept that, well, then we're all going to be happy. And according to the software that is going into the computer at the moment, when they press the final button, we're going to have peace on earth, goodwill towards men. Now, the only time that I really can conceive that this idea was fostered before was in Scripture, where it tells us that the Redeemer was taken out onto a high mountain and shown the whole world. Must have been a fascinating display. There's the whole of Latin America, and there's the whole of Europe, whole of North America, that great vast piece of land that goes right across to Siberia, Southeast Asia, China, Australasia. And the dark power says, how would you like power over all that? You can do anything you want. You can make everybody dress the same. Everybody can have the same haircuts. When you say jump, everybody jumps. If you want them all to stand as the sun comes up at the dawn and raise their right hands, everybody will do that. Or kneel down when it goes to bed at night. Stand on their heads when you say stand on their heads. Anything you want, you can do. It's like taking a little boy into a Lego shop at the age of 4 or 5 and saying, look, we'll give you the whole lot, you just make any shape you want. And it, to me, is very significant that Christ rejected that temptation. He was not particularly interested in power mechanisms or computers or bureaucracies or armies or spears or atom bombs. He was interested in each person as a person and how that person developed and related and used his life, whether he made a success of the freedom he'd been given or whether he mucked it up, but nevertheless he had to have the right to try, he or she. And that is the game that is now coming to some culmination point in the world. My own opinion is it comes to some sort of focal point within an incredibly short period of time. It might be as little as 5 or 6 or 7 years before, finally, we make a decision. We might have to go through a pretty dark period of pain before finally we realize the implication of what is really going on in this world. I was just thinking of this when we read the news that they're closing down the steel industry in Newcastle. All right, how many more have been closed down? We've closed down ports and harbors and downsized everything and tried to make it more efficient. But there's something unique about that steel industry, because it, the first steel industry in Australia was BHP that opened in 1874, I think it was. It wasn't actually in Newcastle. It was up just outside Broken Hill, and the reason they picked that was because it was a meeting place between iron ore and coking coal, which they brought from different directions, and the first little smelters developed there. But from there on, it went down to Newcastle, and then Port Kembla, and then Whyalla, and we became a giant steel nation, as we ought to be, because we have some of the biggest iron ore deposits in the world and the greatest coking coal, and for some reason, apparently, we can't get it together now and continue what those early pioneers were doing in 1875. Crazy stuff. So you shut down a city and you say to everybody you're going to lose your jobs, and they become non-persons. You see, we've divided humanity into two groups now. Those who have occupations, who are entitled to names and title deeds and a reasonable standard of living, and those who have lost their jobs or been downsized or simply cast out into non-humanity. And the misery out there is pretty painful now. We've done it to the farmers, and we've done it to working families and small businesses, and we've only just started. We've really only just started. The Financial Review told us actually what Newcastle has done, because 5 years ago they went to the steel workers there and said, look, you've got to get more efficient. You've got to produce more coal per man. Financial Review, 2 days ago, produced a graph. In 1990, they were producing 320 tons per man, and last year they hit 700. That's over double the production, and it's not good enough to keep them in a job. Why? Because the requirement is they've got to go to 1,000 tons per man. But that's not going to be good enough, even if they go there. They might work 9 or 10 hours if they want to, but the latest mills now coming in, which are automated and much smaller and use new technology, are producing 5 or 6,000 tons per man. Most of it is robotics now. You don't need humanity sweating away at the coal face and in front of a great steaming cauldron of molten iron. All that's in the past. In fact, they're going back to the mini mills. The little mini mills that could be decentralized around the place are now beginning to change the face of the iron and steel industry. So what is going to happen is that most of those new mills so far have gone into low-wage countries like Korea, where you get people prepared to work. In fact, we were asking them to invest in Australia not long ago. Double the hours of Australians, cut away their family life, live on a bowl of rice, and perhaps they can be entitled to a job, presumably. And Australia can't now afford to put together these two assets that it's got. There's something wrong somewhere. And if we continue to allow that to happen, heaven help us. So I'm going to try and give you a picture of the general program, and then we'll get back to some ideas of what could be done. Seems to me this was epitomized in a speech that our former Foreign Minister Gareth Evans made to the Trilateral Commission in Tokyo in 1991. Has anybody here heard of the Trilateral Commission? About half a dozen people. Trilateral Commission is probably one of the most influential power movements in the world. It's far more influential than the Howard government or the Blair government or the major government in England. It was put together in 1972 by one of the biggest bankers in the world, David Rockefeller, who formed a think tank. The genius, the program, was provided by Zygi Brzezinski, the former Secretary of State in America. And he said, what we want is a program to regionalize the world into blocks, trading blocks. Three. One based around Europe, one based around the Americas, and one based around Japan in Southeast Asia. And we will get together the smartest teams in the world, and we will produce the programs that the governments will follow. Trilateral. That's why it's called trilateral. Why don't you see it written up in The Age and The Australian and The Sydney Morning Herald? Because it meets in confidentiality, like the Bilderbergers, if you've heard of the Bilderbergers. The reporters are not allowed in there. They can deal with a few of the crumbs that are left at the end, but that sort of stuff does not come out in the media. You haven't seen an ABC program on the Trilateral Commission, and yet there was Gareth Evans up there addressing one of the most star-studded bodies in the world. There's his speech, produced by the Foreign Affairs and Trade Department. Anybody can write in for it. Of course, they don't. And in his speech, this was made on April the 20th, 1991, Gareth Evans lined up what had been done to Australia to prepare it for the trilateral program. It was one, I think, of the most debasing, groveling speeches I've ever read. We have shaped Australia for this program. We've done four things to it. And I want to tell you about, this is Gareth Evans, roughly paraphrased. I want to tell you about the Australia. Before we started on this program, it was a total misfit, to use his exact words. It was a sort of archaic outpost of European Anglo-Saxondom and the white idea stuck down in the Southern Hemisphere. We had to turn that perception on its head. And we did it by two things. The first of those was immigration. We completely opened the doors of immigration, and you will be thrilled to hear that this is increasingly a multicultural nation. More and more and more, we try and insist that the old immigrants from the past who came from Europe and England are cut down in favor of an increasing multicultural group. We have hundreds of nations moving into Australia now. That's the first achievement. The second achievement, he said, that has made Australia eligible for this is that we have totally deregulated the economy. We have taken away every barrier that protected Australian industries. We've deregulated the banks and the rest of it. The third thing is, and you'll be thrilled to hear this, I'm sure, is we have totally changed Australia's defense system. No longer do we view our defense from a national point of view, but as a regional defense bloc. And from now on, the soldiers and sailors on whom we depend for our defense will not simply be Australian. They will be part of a bloc defense force. And that means that we have to downgrade the old national idea of Australians with Australian badges on their uniforms in favor of this new idea. Now, this is Gareth Evans talking to the Trilateral Commission. Let's just go through some of those points. Every opinion poll that we have had for about 25 years has shown that the majority of Australians do not want large coloured immigration or a multicultural society. That is not to say, as is so often suggested, that they are therefore racist or hate other races or anything else. They just simply prefer some type of homogeneity in their community. In other words, agreed values, an agreed social perception, which obviously has room for dissent. But every opinion poll, rightly or wrongly, don't get me wrong, is saying that that's what the Australian people felt. And so at a speech that Bob Hawke, the former Prime Minister, while he was Prime Minister, made up in Brisbane in 1993, when he was launching a book on this issue, he said, "We've always had disagreements between the opposition and the government, but there has been one issue on which there has been a complicit pact, and that is that neither of us will open up the immigration issue to discussion, because we know that what we are doing is what the people don't want." Now, the book he was launching was written by Professor McAllister, the Professor of Politics at the Australian Defence Force Academy. And this is what the article in The Australian describing this said. He says there has been an implicit pact between the main parties to implement broad policies on immigration they know are not generally endorsed by the electorate. This has been achieved, he says, by keeping the subject off the political agenda. Mr. Hawke said the argument lacked completeness in that it ignored the role played by the ACTU, but the pact between the parties had been quite unique in Australian political experience. There are no other issues on which the major political parties have been prepared to act in this way, with a common cement of ACTU support to advance the national interest ahead of where they believe the electorate to be, he said. In other words, there's a small group at the centre who know better than the ordinary people what is good for them in the field of immigration. That was then followed by a paper by Dr. Betts, who pointed out how this had been done. The chairman of sociology at Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, Dr. Catherine Betts, who's contributed a chapter to the book, claimed it was difficult to question immigration in Australia because of the new class ideology that links such questions with racism. Remember, this is 1993. Pauline Hanson hadn't been heard of. The response to Mr. Howard's criticism of multiculturalism and his quest for One Australia in 1988 was proof that any deviance from the principle would be severely sanctioned, she said. Did you notice something about that last paragraph? John Howard advocated one nation in 1988. Who's advocating it now? Pauline Hanson. And who's attacking her? Amazing, isn't it? Radical questions about the purpose of immigration had been repressed, and the personal costs of attempting to raise them had been demonstrated once again, just as they had been in 1984. Dr. Betts said two main immigration support groups had emerged in Australia since the 1980s, that which defined it as an economic policy that promoted national wealth, and that which saw it as an international altruism. Both groups wore the new class badge of belonging, of being ideologically sound on immigration. They supported substantial immigration and condemned racism, but differed on the composition of the intake. Dr. Betts said much of the public debate on the subject was between these groups, even though immigration itself was not popular with the public at large. So Australia was crucified for adopting the same policy as all its Asian neighbors, none of whom will allow multicultural policy, from Japan south, whether it's China or whether it's Malaysia, or whether it's Indonesia. Apparently we are the ones who've got to do it. And the whole of the policy has been changed without any reference. And the real fear about Pauline Hanson, again, whether you like her or whether you don't, is that she has made it possible to at least discuss the question. And in the end, I think it's got to be the Australian people who make up their mind which way they want to go. And the fact that she is being attacked by the parties is, I believe, is simply an assumption of their own guilt more than anything else, because they were saying exactly what she was saying 5 and 6 and 7 years ago. Very interesting article I picked up from the National Party. Mr. Borbidge, whatever you think of him, our premier up in Queensland, is belting into Pauline Hanson. Only on one issue. He doesn't really care about the race thing, but we could lose markets. The almighty dollar is the only thing he's concerned about. If we've got to sell the country to get the dollar in, that's the way we ought to go. But his own party, 25 years ago, passed, was right firm. This came out July the 24th, 1972. The Australian Country Party, as it was then, must reaffirm its support for its restrictive immigration policy, said the state president at the party's conference. Mr. Sparks, who is state president of the party, said he was deeply concerned at evidence of the watering down of this policy in official statistics, which showed that between 1966 and 1971, a total of 104,000 immigrants of non-European origin entered Australia. That's the National Party. Now, talk about hypocrisy. Talk about hypocrisy. It's the most difficult single question in the world, but I want to tell you, anybody here who has lived in a country that has attempted the multicultural program or the multiracial program will know that it's the most difficult thing in the world. And you can say that without saying that one nation is superior to another or one race is superior to another. It just happens to be true. I was born in a country where we had 24 different African tribes who were called by the British Africans. They didn't see it that way. They saw themselves as different races. And their national sport was beating each other up, pinching each other's wives, having battles, you know, as part of the program. And it's all re-emerging right across Africa. Nobody knew. We used to have endless debates on what the way was. I think there was an area in which you could try and solve this problem by having part of the country where people could meet, but also an area that different races could retreat into if they found it difficult to or wanted to express their own cultural identity. It's one of the most difficult questions. And for Australians who haven't got that problem, really, to start preaching to others on how to solve it really is a form of arrogance. Until somebody else has solved it successfully, we've got to be very careful about what we're doing. That's my own opinion, anyhow. The second issue was we have totally deregulated Australia. This is Gareth Evans before the Trilateral Commission. It was done with himself and with also Paul Keating and Bob Hawke as the Prime Minister. And so without going through the whole history, let's just go back to 1983, which is now 14 years ago, where the Hawke government got into power. And you might remember the treasurer-to-be, Mr. Paul Keating, campaigning right round Victoria on that issue at the time. If you put the Labour in power, there is one thing we guarantee we won't do, and that is we will not let the foreign banks into Australia. It was written up in the papers. It was in The Age. He made it in a number of country speeches. Whatever else we're going to do, we're not going to let foreign banks into this country. You can be absolutely sure that you can trust us to keep banking and money and finance and debt in the hands of the Australian people. I think within 6 weeks of the election, the doors had been opened and 17 huge international banks came in under the argument they'd had a second look at it and it was going to make banking more competitive. Interest rates would come down, better services, less charges, all the things that you've enjoyed so much since then. Well, in they came and we then went through a period where we did a number of things that were, I think, the form of absolute insanity. The first thing that happened was we began to destroy rural Australia. I don't know whether you've looked at the figures recently, but from a high of 290,000 farmers at the end of the 60s, we're down now below 100,000. We've got rid of about 200,000 primary producers. It started off as a quite deliberate policy under a slogan announced, incidentally, by Doug Anthony, "Get big or get out." Does anybody remember that? And the argument was, it is true we've got a small number of farmers who are never going to be able to do more than scratch along, and if we got rid of 10%, it would consolidate and make things better for the remainder who would remain in prosperity. We are, after all, one of the great producing nations in the world. We're the biggest beef exporter in the world, the biggest sugar exporter in the world. One of the biggest wheat, well, we're not one of the biggest, but we're one of the highest per capita wheat producers in the world. And the only trouble with get big or get out is that you keep shifting the goalposts. If you're going to have rising costs, in the end, the economic unit's got to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so progressively, we have got rid of 200,000 farmers, and the figures have just come out for what is left for the remainder. They came out in a paper that was given in Toowoomba just at the end of last year, which was called by wives of farmers. Wives right across the Darling Downs called an urgent rural summit because so many of their husbands were suicidal. The suicide rate has gone right through the roof. Worse than the beef industry than anywhere else because it's been a total disaster. And they call this conference into Woomba, and this is what the press report said. At the rural summit in July 1996, an ex-banker, Chris Shearer, produced a paper sponsored by the Australian Bankers Association, and based on information supplied by the Australian Bureau of Resource Economics, ABARE, and undoubtedly the best informed set of figures available. He showed that 88% of the remaining beef producers were at risk, 76% of sheep producers were at risk, 54% of general farmers and 52% of cotton farmers were at risk. At risk means their interest payments were greater than their total incomes, and the list proceeded through all primary industry activities. The average of all pursuits was approximately 75% at risk. Now, unless something is done to challenge those figures and change it round, it means that of the, 96,000 we've got left, something in the region of 70 to 75% are destined to go. In other words, the family farm won't exist in Australia any longer. And behind this great trudge off the land, which is now 200,000, go all the infrastructure that surrounds the farming industry, the country school and the small country towns and the businesses and the bus services and the railways, which are closed down out to many of those areas. And much is deserted at the moment, but it won't remain a vacuum for long. It can't remain a vacuum for long. So with a very, very small population of 18 million, which is smaller than Tokyo by midday on Monday, the total population of Australia, we have now rammed 83% into two or three metropolitan areas. We are the most urbanized country in the world, and we seem bent on increasing that. Now, if we continue to do what we've done, and it's almost done now, I mean, the disaster in the bush is quite horrific. There's going to come a time when the question is going to be asked, what are you going to do with your rural areas? You obviously don't want them in Australia because you've got rid of all the people who live there and put them down in Melbourne and Sydney and Perth and Adelaide. Some of them went to Newcastle, but you've shifted them out and they're going back to the metropolitan areas. And it's about time you moved over in some of the best agricultural land in the world and let somebody else have a go. And what's the answer going to be at that time? What noble politician is going to stand up and say, this is only temporary, we're going to repopulate our country areas, we're going to get young farmers back in the bush, we're going to bring down the cost structure, we're going to have villages and hamlets, we're going to rebuild the ecology of our soil and get back our waterways. That's on the program. Don't you think you're coming in to stop us doing that? Who's going to be the one who tells Southeast Asia or China or Singapore, where they have 12,500 people per square mile in that place, and yet they can run an orderly society? Or Hong Kong, which is about to disgorge a huge number of Chinese and are looking for somewhere to go. Alexander Downer, would he be there telling them? He's too busy belting Pauline Hanson at the moment. And it's a fair argument, because you can't do what we're doing to Australia and still claim the right to maintain or to keep the whole continent if you can't even keep a farming community in place. So that's what we've done to the countries. I've just done a trip down around the wheat belt in Western Australia. It's a tragedy, absolutely, because you're going, you know, I was lecturing in towns that I'd lectured in 20 years ago that were thriving, busy country towns with their country schools and the pub open and farmers coming in at the end of the day after a hot day's work and having a beer and full of bustle and opportunities for young people. They're just like ghost towns now, totally deserted. And a few grim-faced, red-eyed graziers come in who are at the end of their tether. And that really all they can think of, even when you're running a lecture, is how the heck are we going to pay the bank? And what do we do about the interest bill? And where on earth can I go if I'm driven off my farm? You talk about housing shortages, the houses there are just falling down. I have done a video through this. We went through towns in the Riverina without one single soul living in the town. Houses there, still with flowers growing in the gardens. Paper blowing down the main street, the pub boarded up. And they're down here, pressing, cramming into metropolitan urban structures where the whole infrastructure is so expensive and so lopsided now that it's difficult to maintain services. So you put tolls on the road where people go in and out. You know, what a great way to run a country. Seems crazy to me. How did all this happen? Well, it happened when Australia made the fatal decision. Right back in the 50s, we had, whatever else you say, the country that opened up BHP and it opened up the steel and it opened up this country had reached the highest standard of living in the world by the turn of the century, and we let it slide. We had worked out how to finance this country. We didn't have to borrow money overseas. We financed some of our First World War efforts and other war efforts without going to the big bankers overseas. We wouldn't have dreamt of having a foreign debt like we've got now. But at the end of the Second World War, we made a fatal decision when a bill went before the Parliament called the International Income Tax Assessment Bill. And basically it said this: in order to develop Australia faster and better, we need much more foreign expertise in this country. And the only way to attract that in is to offer inducement. And the inducement we're going to offer is that any foreign corporation that comes into Australia can operate and repatriate its profits tax-free. So you develop two groups of people. The Australian battler, who was paying a higher and higher level of tax on his small unit, whether it was a farm or whether it was a small business, or his wages if he was a worker. And a number of giants that began to come in. We didn't even say to them, only if you build a new industry. We let them buy out the industry that we'd already established and repatriate their profits back to their own countries without paying tax on it. And only about three politicians spoke against the bill when it went through. One was a left-wing Labour bloke, Clive Cameron. But that was enough to set the ball rolling, and foreign ownership became a major problem. And that was added to in 1975 when we passed that crazy thing, the Lima Declaration. And it became part of Australia's policy. Now, what is the Lima Declaration? It was ostensibly an offer that was put forward, or a solution that was put forward to the problem of third world debt, which was disastrous. The whole third world has been wrecked on the debt crisis. And if you haven't read about it, read Susan George's stuff. The total destruction of ecologies and peasant economic systems and families and the starvation that you can see and the battle that you can see in Rwanda and Burundi, which was just over the border from where I lived. You will find the causes for that written up in Susan George's book. She said it's debt that has produced this disaster and this crazy hunger for land and the hatred that goes with it. We have done that sort of thing in many of those communities over there, and it's true. The way to fix their debt problem, we were told, is for nations like Australia and Canada and industrial Europe and Asia, which never got sucked in. They were much too smart. Wind your industries down. Let their resources be shifted into the third world so they can produce what you used to produce, and then they can earn money by exporting stuff back to you that you used to make yourself, and then they've got the money to pay the bankers, you see. Held at a big conference of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization in Peru, and Australia gladly went along with that. It's culminated right through now in the World Trade Organization. By 1976, 1 year after that Lima thing, the OECD produced a set of figures for the nations that had the highest foreign ownership in the world. The nations they listed: Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, Finland, France, Germany, Japan, New Zealand, Norway, Spain, Sweden, UK, and USA. And who was number one on the list for the highest level of foreign ownership of the whole lot? Was it the United States or was it New Zealand? No, it was Australia. Now, this is 21 years ago, before the onslaught started. Mining, 55% foreign owned. Manufacturing, 36%. Services, including finance, 48%. Chemicals, coal, rubber, petroleum, 62%. Fabricated metals, 46%. Food, beverages, tobacco, 29%. Basic metal industries, 44%. The only one that came near us was Canada. They'd got sucked in on the same thing. We were literally flogging the country off. How can you run it when you say to the big boys overseas, you come in tax-free and we'll pay for our development by taxing our own people more? 1986, it was becoming so obvious, that was 10 years after those, that the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade was ordered
to stop publishing the figures on foreign ownership. Too many people were getting alarmed. We had top industrialists and engineers speaking out on the matter. Governors, Sir Mark Oliphant, exposed the thing. So don't let the people know what's going on. So it's very difficult to get the final figures. But now here we are in 1997, and I just want to give you a short picture. You will notice now that our dollar is slowly devaluing. Have you noticed that? It's gone from 81 cents down to about 77 cents, and they're expecting it to go further down. Our net foreign debt, every time that happens, goes up further. Net foreign debt now $196 billion. It's costing us $11 billion a year just to service that debt. That's about $600 for every living person, from the little baby sleeping to the oldest person here tonight, just in interest on the foreign debt. The growth of foreign debt, $2 million an hour now for 19 years. That's how it's grown. $2 million every 60 minutes. Foreign ownership now, as far as we can work it out, processed food 95%, chemicals 98%, cars 100%, pharmaceuticals 98%, mining 97%, banking 86%, confectionery and drinks 84%, manufacturing 57%, insurance 82%, building materials 88%, hotel 75%, oil and gas 92%. Now, who owns that? What basically happened as this program developed was that a small number of banks, and don't think I'm knocking banks, we need banks, but these banks not only lent to nations, but created the money to lend. It was new money that was sent out in the form of credit, and big interest bills were charged on it. And behind those loans went a small number of multinationals, and it's incredible how small they are. About 500 companies control now just on 50% of the world's production. 500 companies. The giants that you see advertised in every country you go to, from Coca-Cola to Caterpillar tractors to whatever it happens to be. You know the names as well as I do. Now, if you go back to their source country, you will find that the directorships of the banks and the directorships of the multinationals are the same people. So they are not one industry that produces money and another industry that actually runs corporations. They are closely interlinked. And that is why I believe, I can't prove this, we are now seeing Australian companies trying to export with borrowed money. They haven't missed one payment, but all of a sudden the bank comes in and closes them down. You might have seen the story of the little guy trying to build a beer factory in China. $2 million. He hadn't missed one payment and the bank suddenly said, we're foreclosing. Now, who picked up the contract in China? It was a German company. That company in Germany, for all I know, had the same directorship as the bank that foreclosed on the little guy. Now, don't quote me on that because I can't prove it. But more and more of that is happening. And we really need somebody just to investigate that. It's got nothing to do with commercial practice at all. It is simply who owns what now. So that was the level. As we've done this, we have closed down 50% of Australia's manufacturing industry. Behind the terrible exodus of the farmers, all the little companies that kept us reasonably self-sufficient are no more. Because those industries have gone across to Southeast Asian countries. And I might tell you, the trade unions never fought against this. The little unions did, but the ACTU went along with it. And so we began to buy back into Australia the things that we'd made ourselves. And we tacked it up on the bill. That was how the foreign debt went up. It was like somebody going into the pub and just tacking up another beer. Now, I can't pay this week. One day the light will come on at the end of the tunnel. And it's harder and harder to get that last beer now. How do you keep importing when your foreign debt is going up at $2 million an hour for 19 years? And you close down your industries and more people are on welfare. So what has happened in that field? Do you know that we now have 6 million Australians on welfare, supported by 7.8 million taxpayers? But what is happening is every time BHP closes down in Newcastle, or as today's paper said, another 80,000 jobs to go in the public service, it's going to reverse very quickly to 7.8 million welfare people and only 6 million taxpayers. And it's now become obvious that the tax base can't support this, certainly the personal tax base. So we've got a new cry for GST, which we knocked when John Hewson tried to put it in. Why do they want GST? The pressure is coming back on John Howard. Go for GST. A lot of the big manufacturers are saying GST because they can see the government doesn't matter what level of taxation it strikes, has fewer and fewer taxpayers actually paying personal tax. The personal tax base is retracting. So you've got to think of another way of getting money out of the taxpayer, and what better than to make them pay tax every time they buy something, whether they like it or not, whether they're earning, whether they're out of work, whether they're unemployed. And if you want to go to the countries that have got it in, it's the most petty, miserable, narrow-minded tax. You can't do anything without tax. You can't go to a cafe in the main street and have a cup of coffee now, if you're living in New Zealand, without the poor cafe owner having to write you out a docket, charging you for the coffee plus GST. And then at the end of the month, they add it all up and they got to send it in. Yes, it'll work. The little person is crippled by even more paperwork. The big people, the giant corporations, can just put on an extra staff of two and three in a computer, and it doesn't mean much to them. In fact, their company tax might go down. So the pressure for the GST comes from the top, not from the bottom. And nobody actually analyzes why we're paying this level of tax. Well, how much tax are we paying? The Commonwealth now collects $125 billion in direct and indirect taxation. Add up all the taxes that Canberra takes, $125 billion. If you want to average that out across the Australian people, it comes to $131 per person per week. Now, I'm not talking about per adult, I'm talking about per person. So for a mother and father and two kids, their average tax just going to Canberra is $524 a week. Oh, come on, people say, I don't pay that much. Forgetting that every time you get that litre of petrol, or every time you have to have a new fridge, or getting building materials, you're paying that tax into Canberra. Now, $534 a week is an incredibly high level of tax. And most of it is paid in the form of prices with taxes added onto them. What happens if you add another one in the form of GST? Karl Marx once wrote, and this was supported by Keynes, one of the great economists, that once a nation started taxing more than 20% of the income of its people, it was on the road towards the centralized corporate state. We're now over 40. That's double the rate. But you see, Canberra is not the only one collecting taxes. Your state government, under the benign and gentle and generous Mr. Kennett, takes an extra $32 per head per week, which takes you up to what? $153 per head now, and then you've got your rates to pay on top of that. So that the average person is paying now round about $170 a week per head in their taxes. Boy, have they got us by the throat. They get into power by promising to have a tax cut and say, watch my lips, but it never actually happens. And if they do manage to get one in, they simply tack it on to something else somewhere else. The actual aggregate of taxes has gone steadily up and up and up, and as a percentage of the income of the people, it goes up and up and up, so that there are no savings left. And every time you want to look for some investment money to buy Australian or to invest in an Australian company, they all complain because the people aren't saving enough money. They can't. They're up to here. It's an incredibly difficult business for the average family just to stay level with this thing. Now, it is understood all of a sudden, and I think whatever else you say about Pauline Hanson, she has done this. A lot of the issues that have been suppressed have now been discussed. One of those is the racial question. I don't agree with everything she says, but at least she's got the courage to say it. One of those is foreign ownership. And the foreign ownership thing is coming right out into the open now. You can't go to 90% without people really being shocked. So we're now being asked to accept a new type of international treaty. This is coming out of the World Trade Organization. It's called the MIA. Got to have initials, isn't it? Stands for the Multilateral Investment Agreement, and they want all the nations of the world to sign this agreement that there will be no discrimination in any form against any foreign corporation investing in your country. If you sign that, it means that even if you want to change your mind afterwards, or you get some brave politician who said, let's go for buying Australia back for the Australian people, that now is against an international treaty. If we sign that, we're gone, we're suckers, we're absolutely finished. That's about where we are. How do we know about this level of foreign investment if the government isn't publishing the figures? Well, strangely enough, we've got one or two tax officials now beginning to reveal what is going on. This came out in the Courier Mail 2 days before I left to come down on this trip. and they were talking about the latest financial inquiry, the Wallace Commission report. Not only the farm, but factories, hotels, and shares are heading overseas to foreign owners at record rates. Foreign ownership in Australia is set to go above $500 billion by the year 2000. According to the recent Wallace report, Australia has a massive and growing imbalance when it comes to investment flows. While foreign firms have invested $444 billion in Australia, offshore investment by the country's globe-trotting companies stands at only $156 billion. Foreigners earn a record 32.5%, or $109 billion of Australia's listed shares. As a result, more than $20 billion a year in dividends and profits heads offshore. It's much more than that. In 1990, a chap who lives just near me, John Cummins, he's now in his 70s, and he used to be the head of the biggest advertising company in Australia, based down here in Melbourne, now retired. And he started a movement called Ausstand, which just deals with one issue, foreign ownership. The former proprietor of one of Australia's largest advertising and public relations firms obtained verbal information, unpublished, from within Treasury that somewhere between 80 and 100 billion was leaving Australia tax-free as a result of the 1953 income tax assessment bill. John Cummins' organisation, Ausstand, has updated the figure, taking account of asset sales since then, and estimates the untaxed profits now leaving Australia annually at $200 billion. $200 billion every year going out without paying any tax, which if it was just taxed at the same rate as Australians, could bring our total tax down by $60 billion a year. Be enough to wipe out sales tax and payroll tax and a number of other taxes which would allow, I would say, probably a 6 or 7% increase in employment, no problem at all. Neither Treasury nor government will confirm or deny these figures. They have stopped publishing this information since 1986. According to Bob Santa Maria, writing in the Weekend Australian just the other day, the head of the Taxation's Office International Tax Division has already stated publicly that the vast majority of local and foreign multinationals pay little or no tax in Australia. He added that 60% claimed to be in loss and paid no tax, while the great bulk of the remaining 40% claimed to be only marginally profitable and paid only a small amount of tax. On January the 28th of this year, the Sydney Morning Herald published an interview with Mr. Jim Killaley, Assistant Commissioner, Australian Tax Office, concerning the tax privileges given to foreign-owned companies, in which Mr. Killaley said this tax advantage enabled them to systematically take over Australian-owned companies, leaving us with insufficient tax to maintain essential services, enabling us to sell further assets and escalating unemployment. He added, Australia has one of the highest levels of foreign ownership in the industrial world. The next thing we're selling off, urged by the federal government, is the whole public transport system of Australia. We're selling Cullum Marine, ports and the harbours, and Qantas and banks, and you name it what we're selling off. And now we're down to, you know, the last scratching the bottom of the barrel. We're selling the waterworks and Loy Yang, and we managed to get the debt down fractionally in one area, but if you look at the total debts of Australia, all this privatisation, which is simply another way of flogging your stuff overseas, has not reduced our debts, which it was supposed to do. It has not really produced efficiency in every area it was supposed to do. Witness the story of what's happening to your ambulance service here as a result of privatisation, etc., etc., etc. So we are in the most incredible mess. More and more of the world taken over, and they believe that what is going to happen is that all this now will end in a world under national competition, because that's what the Hilmer Report is, level playing field, where a small number of banks have the whole world in debt, allowing their own multinationals, which they own, to go over out there and take over the existing productive system. And the result of this is came out in the 1996 United Nations Human Development Report. Came out in a report, I've read a number of them, this was in The Guardian. The year's most halting statistic has come in the United Nations Human Development Report 1996, Take It Slowly. The total wealth of the world's 358 billionaires equals the combined incomes of the poorest 45% of the world's population, 22.1 billion people. We've got 358 individuals who now own more than about the poorest half of the total world's population. But they haven't got enough, you see. They need a bit more. And if we just gave them a bit more power and forgot all this business about elections and freedom, Well, then we're going to have peace on earth, as I said, and goodwill towards men. Wouldn't it be lovely? I'd like to finish by saying this. I don't believe that we're going to see the completion of this thing. Because one of the factors about centralized power, however good your computer, is that you've only got to get one fraction of a percent wrong, and the model you're working on begins to create a bow wave of problems. It may simply not have taken account of human individuality, who knows, that gets bigger than the efficiency which it's supposed to generate. The world is not going to see a nice takeover by some sort of dictatorship. The world is going to see a period of chaos and breakdown and anarchy. That's what I think is going to happen. And I am petrified that the sort of things we're beginning to see developing in wherever it is, Bosnia or Russia, which is a horrific case. They reckon Russia is worse than Bosnia. You don't go in there without making arrangements to the mafia now for personal protection. Or Burundi or Rwanda or what is happening in India or what is happening in other parts of the world begins to move into countries like Australia. You see, you can only tolerate so much. Even the meekest and mildest of people reach the point where if their families and their kids are being destroyed, they become pretty angry and they become violent. And if we cannot produce a movement here in Australia that has got an alternative to that and has got a spiritual basis that gets back to the idea of freedom, it's quite easy to lose this country. Believe you me, I've gone through and seen the destruction of one country. I've been through a civil war. Pray God it never happens here. The fact is about civil war is that nobody believes it could ever happen until it starts. And then they're petrified and desperate. And the Australian people have got a great capacity for getting organized to do things if they can see what the problem is. But this is a different type of problem. It's a sort of invidious thing that is just taking more and more people and putting them into the realms of non-existence. And yet we've got so much going for us. If ever there was a country could come through this mess with the resources we've got, we're the top, we're the prize. We've got more minerals and assets and individuality and know-how and really goodwill and faith than an awful lot of countries. And yet this feeling of doom and helplessness is so wide now that even politicians privately can see they're not sure what the answer is. They can belt Pauline Hanson as much as they like, but you ask them, all right, what's your answer? How can Alexander Downer say to Pauline Hanson, if we listen to her, we're going to get huge unemployment, when the whole country is now being wrecked with the thing? What is his answer then? Would Australia regain control of its financial system? Is it really so unjust to say, as Australians, Australians should come first? We don't want to knock anybody else, but our own kids are very important to us. I can't see there's anything wrong with it. I think it's part of the natural order. And from that base, we will help others. So people say, oh my goodness, who am I going to vote for next time? I haven't got a clue. I wish I could say to you that Pauline Hanson will sweep into power. I don't think she's got a dog's chance. Why do I say that? We just had an election in Britain where they had one party campaigning on one issue with £20 million. That's $40 million to spend under Sir James Goldsmith. And the issue was, should we have a referendum on Europe? I doubt if they got one person in. I haven't heard the latest figures. I'd like to think they have. We're stuck with this two-party thing. The real question is, how do we empower ourselves to make it change? That's the question. And it really involves coming back to you as a person. There's nobody else can do it. Where you get a group of people in an area who are beginning to work together and are committed to each other and will support each other through desperate times, out of this comes a type of ethos that gets things done. We keep hoping for some miracle new politician to come and change things, do it for us. It's not going to happen that way. It's going to happen in small communities, small groups, families getting together, older people getting back together with the young people. That's a much harder proposition. I wish I had a blueprint I could give you. Said it's easy. It's much harder. We've got a good meeting here tonight. If you could see the amount of work that people here in Lilydale have gone through to get this far, small numbers of people, you'd be amazed. They've really struggled. Some people have left because it seemed too hard, but they've kept going. And that's really what this seminar is about tomorrow. Take 12 hours. Start at 9 in the morning, we go till 9 o'clock at night. And I do ask you to come. Oh, people say, don't say that. And I know the world is collapsing, but 12 hours. Well, the people in Albania have marched for 78 days in minus 20 degrees temperatures to keep their freedom. That's how desperate they are. So if there's any way any of you can make that 12 hours, come and do it. It's not going to offer you a quick, slick fix, but it's going to teach you some principles that, if applied, could change Australia around. We don't just deal with money and economics. We deal with some spiritual things. That doesn't mean I'm going to ram church down your throat. You'll be thrilled to hear. But there can be no such thing as a nation that survives without spiritual values. It's either love or hate, both of which are spiritual in a sense. It's either destroy or mend. Those are spiritual ideas. And then we go right through the morning looking at how Australia was built and the Constitution and why it's being wrecked and what needs to be done about it. And then we start in the afternoon on what we could do to get Australia out of debt, which could be done reasonably simply. And then we finish off in the evening by having a look at what we're going to do out of this. We ran 22 in Queensland last year, running from north of Cairns right down, actually as far as Newcastle. And we've now begun to network together. And those networks have produced some interesting results. And we need to build on that. You've just got a perfect model here. So if there's anybody here, we don't care if you're 99 or 15. It won't cost you anything if you're broke. There's no charge for this thing. We're going to ask for donations because we've got to somehow cover costs. But if you're in that situation where you haven't got a job and you don't know how you're going to survive, come anyhow. You'll get a set of notes and you'll get the Constitution. And you might end up part of a team that really makes things work. We need ordinary Australians. And we better get moving because we're just about out of time. Thank you very much.